What's up, freaks? This is your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. Before we jump into the ads, got to read the top four boosts from Rip 444, Palindrome, Rip, Fiat Ruins Everything with Jimmy Song, at Blockchain Bug, 5,000 sats. What exactly is a fiat job? Bitcoin Kook gave a good response in the comments on Fountain. One, a job where you get paid in fiat, and two, a job that provides no value to society, usually caused by the misaligned incentives that lack the lack of free markets brings along. It's a good definition there. At DSMK MPLXX 1000 sats, the Bitcoin cowboy himself. That's Jimmy. Wore his hat. At Bitcoin underscore kook 420 sats. If you're not paying attention, you probably should be. Heart emoji, prayer emoji. And at MCOT EMCOT 378 sats, a book for Bitcoiners. Cheers and thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, freaks, for boosting the show. If you're participating in the value for value model on podcasting 2.0, we greatly appreciate it here at TFTC. Keeps us coming back week in and week out. This rip was brought to you by our good friends at River. River is a company that's doing it the right way. They build their own infrastructure. They build their own wallets. They're getting their own MTLs. And they've got customer support. You can call River if you have a question. Okay. And they've got a new onboarding plan. So if you go to river.com/TFTC, you sign up, buy $100 worth of Bitcoin, you're going to get $5 worth of Bitcoin. River.com/TFTC. If you want to DCA into Bitcoin, there's no fees when you DCA on River. Other exchanges have high fees, high spreads. You don't have that with River. Save some money by dollar cost averaging with River. Again, they have a customer support line. If you ever have a question, you want to call them, they will answer the phone. My neighbor called them the other week. They answered. They answered his question. They made him feel more comfortable. Good customer service. It's hard to find these days. Not with River. Go to river.com/TFTC. Set up your account today. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends down the hall, Unchained. They're doing things the right way as well, leveraging Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties to bring you the financial platform of the future. A financial platform under a Bitcoin standard. And they have their vault, which is a 2 or 3 multi-sig wallet where you hold 2 keys. Unchained holds 1. You always have control of your Bitcoin since you have the 2 keys. Unchained's there to collaboratively sign with you if you need them to be the second in the 2 or 3 multi-sig. They also have their lending desk, which is built on this 2 or 3 multi-sig primitive. You put Bitcoin up as collateral in a 2 or 3 multi-sig escrow. You hold 1 key. You don't control the Bitcoin, but you have visibility into the wallet so that you know your Bitcoin is not being rehypothecated. They also have their IRA product, which allows you to hold 2 keys in a 2 or 3 multi-sig quorum, Unchained being the other key. And you can actually transition your IRA into Bitcoin, hold your own keys. It's a beautiful thing. They've streamlined that process, made it a lot easier within the last month. They've got a lot of things on the roadmap. They're about to go gangbusters on the product rollouts, from what I understand. So stay tuned for that. You can also buy Bitcoin on Unchained via their trading desk. You buy Bitcoin, go straight to your 2 or 3 multi-sig vault. So they're doing it the right way. They're really innovating. I think they're one of the best companies in the space. If you are interested in any of these products, go to unchained.com/consultation, set up a consultation, tell them that TFTC sent you. Just learn about it. You don't have to ape into their products, but I think you should learn about them. So set up a consultation. They have a concierge onboarding team that'll walk you through everything they're working on. unchained.com/consultation. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. It is a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. So if you're a company in the space looking to hire the best talent, go to Bitcoin Talent Co. and get set up with them. They understand Bitcoin at the protocol level. They understand Lightning. They understand mining. They have the ability to find what you need. And they come from a very strong background in recruiting. Andy led the recruiting team at Uber, taking them from, I believe, 100 to 10,000 employees. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to do this. He knows how to understand your processes. They also just launched their Flex program. So if you don't need full-time employees, if you're being hypercognizant of your burn rate and how you're allocating capital in these tough economic times, their Flex product allows you to tap into a network of workers who can work on contract and can do quick sprints for you, whether it's design, development, marketing, anything that you may need. So go to bitcointalent.co, tell them that TFTC sent you. If you're a company looking to hire full-time employees, if you're looking for some contract work, get set up with them. And then alternatively, if you're talent out there looking to get into the Bitcoin industry, hit them up, get your profile out there, and get your name in the mix to come join the industry building out the Bitcoin standard. Enjoy this rip. High signal. Dicky.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Oh, you don't want to keep you too long from the fiat mines.
Yeah, I got a pig for life. I'm trying to save up so that I don't have to use credit or cold storage for my trip to Africa in December. That's
why are you going to Africa?
I'm going to the Bitcoin conference.
Oh, hell yeah. Yes.
Same way I ended up in El Salvador. I was just like, you guys want someone to speak about nuclear power? And they're like, yes, yes, we like nuclear power. And it's a benefit that I'm also familiar with Bitcoin because a lot of the nuclear people, they kind of get it on the surface, but they got a ways to go.
So how did you get into nuclear power to begin with?
I'm a chemical technologist. So I went to college just learning how to do basic chemistry and using instruments like mass spectrometers, ICPs, AAs, just all of the fancy instruments that do various chemical analysis. And then I got laid off a few times and then ended up here at Canadian Nuclear Labs 9 years ago. And then I've just been, I work in a lab that specifically monitors the corrosion in the pressure tubes in the Canadian CANDU reactors.
And why is it important to monitor that?
Because it will embrittle the pressure tubes after a while, and then the pressure that they're under, it risks cracking, and then you can leak the moderator water into the cooling water, and it's a expensive, time-consuming mess to clean up. It's nothing catastrophic, but something that it's easy to avoid if it's monitored.
Okay. All right, that's good to know. All right, let's jump into it because, I mean, we're already recording, but we had a big event here in Texas last week. It's part of the reason why I reached out to you. I saw that you followed the TFTC account and then retweeted one of our tweets, or I retweeted.
Yeah, it was something with Peter St. Onge. I was, railing against windmills because just their economics don't make sense unless they have stupid amounts of tax credits and subsidies.
Well, you're providing the perfect segue because that's part of the reason why I wanted to talk today is last week in Texas, we've got a bunch of new demand that's come on to our grid over the last few years as people have moved here, as industry has moved here, excuse me. And we had an incident last week where we almost had rolling blackouts because demand brushed up with the supply capacity. Luckily, there are some Bitcoin miners engage in demand response to turn off and serve that electricity back to the grid. But this happened around 7 p.m. at night, and it basically came to be known that wind was not producing anywhere near its total capacity. And obviously 7 o'clock at night here in central Texas, the sun goes down. And so solar stops producing energy, creating this supply demand imbalance within ERCOT here in Texas. And this is a problem that's been bubbling up during peak demand periods, whether it's the middle of the winter with the winter storms or the middle of summer with the extreme heat. And over the last 3 years specifically, I think this has become a massive problem here in Texas. And it's really frustrating to me. Not a native born Texan. I'm new to the state, only 2 years in. But the solution to the problem of the supply demand imbalance that pops up during these periods of peak demand seems very obvious in my mind, but for some reason those involved in the grid down here in Texas seem pot committed to expanding wind and solar generation capacity in favor of more reliable sources like nuclear, nat gas, and coal. What's going on down here from your perspective? Like how idiotic is this whole situation?
Yeah, definitely prioritizing one technology over another and interfering with just normal market forces is going to have effects like this, because we see it's basically a narrative that everyone is following, that the climate is in such a chaotic state that we must engage in developing this specific technology or nothing's going to work. Because right now, the big complaint about nuclear that we get from people that are pitching the wind and solar is that it costs too much and it takes too long. And there's a whole history to why that is. It's mostly regulatory related and exaggerating certain safety cases with nuclear power and how that can be sensationalized when shit does go wrong and over exaggerate. So the narrative right now is telling a better story so that these technologies can get a better seat at financing. And historically, nuclear has never had a really good seat at financing, while wind and solar has been riding quite high at very low cost of capital, tax credits galore. They often get paid to not operate just because that's part of the deal. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been built in the first place because there would have been no incentive. But then as that happens, as you start adding more intermittency to your grid, you have to balance that with a stable baseload that will be available for those demand events, because you essentially have to build two grids, because you're going to have your intermittent grid that, yeah, you may have installed capacity that when it's operating, it can cover the baseload requirements that are happening at that time, but then it vanishes. So you need to have a completely secondary grid to call upon when that electricity is required. And that's why, like, there's peaker plants popping up all over the place. And the Bitcoin miners are getting a huge opportunity to play the demand response role. And it just seems like it's over complexifying the management of the grid, when it would be so much easier to just lots of base load that's have enough base load that can cover the most extreme demand events, and then just have something on the load side that can be curtailed to support whatever the grid needs. And you can strategically place it, whether it's at your generators, at your substations, and there's millions of different ways that it can be configured, because it's just, we're just plugging computers and turning them off when there's a higher order customer that needs that electricity. And then we just see how that can play these same roles that we're trying to perform now, but a lot more effectively, a lot more cost effective, and just a lot more efficiency with the technologies that we actually need to engage with on these grids. Because there's a whole host of other technologies that they want to incorporate with, like, nuclear power and baseload, so that we can get more nuclear power off to and built into these grids. But one of the biggest problems is you have to have that certainty of demand if you're going to engage in such, like, high capital expenditures. So it does become a chicken and egg thing, that you have to have certainty of demand before you build the base load. But then with all these other complexing factors, with the intermittency and all these other, like, batteries and hydrogen production that we want to incorporate into it, that it's putting together a very complicated puzzle that I think can be simplified a lot by having a flexible load like Bitcoin mining in the mix.
Yeah, it seems like a Rube Goldberg machine. When you factor in the batteries, again, the hydrogen that you just mentioned, like, there's so much extra infrastructure that needs to go into the wind and solar projects. But if you have strong base load, like nuclear, nat gas, or coal, it's not as complex. It's pretty straightforward. And so I think with that in mind, like, going through the spectrum from nuclear, nat gas, coal, wind, solar, like, what is the most viable energy source for a stable base load in your mind?
Yeah, like, it really depends jurisdictionally, because you're going to have a lot of different factors to consider, especially, like, some places actually, like, do have really good wind and solar resources that they can draw upon. But, like, making your entire grid dependent upon that seems to be a confusing strategy. But some are trying it, so we're going to get to see the example where in some cases it may work, and in some cases we may see examples of it not working so much. But yeah, I like the idea of having a grid where you have the fuel available and you can confidently generate that electricity when the grid calls for it. And trying to predict human demand for electricity is just is not it has its own challenges, and then adding having to predict the weather on top of that adds a whole another layer of challenges. And then if the weather doesn't cooperate with what you are anticipating and you were expecting to have 10 gigawatts of wind online and then you only have 5 gigawatts of wind online, then you have to call upon your peaker plants. And then that's when you've got your different degrees of peaker plants, the ones your spinning reserves that are operating at a partial capacity factor that can ramp up quickly, and then your other peaker plants that'll often be just left off, and they get paid and compensated to just be available and then turn on within a day of expecting that load. So like those services are being called upon more and more often as the complexity of the grid increases with more intermittent sources. And then because of the nature of the peaker plants, they're often the highest cost and highest emission generators on your grid stack. So that will add a whole other like layers of consideration that you have to think about when you're adding new load and adding new generation sources. So like, that's why I'm all in on nuclear very much, but there are definitely areas where nuclear can struggle and not fully displace like hydrocarbons. Like we can get natural gas and coal out of a lot of like electrical generation and mid to high grade like heat applications, like various like industries, like and creating biofuels and chemicals and polymers and a bunch of industries and fertilizer and steel refining and wood products and doing desalination and clean water stuff. Like those are all like good peripheral technologies that can support these. But we're going to need to build as much nuclear as possible to displace as much of our hydrocarbon use in those areas that we can, because then we can displace them to higher order uses. Like instead of using natural gas, like as great as it is for heating and electricity, the less that we need for heating electricity, the more we can apply to creating like fertilizer and other higher order chemicals that we can use for various other industries. And like hydrogen is used in a lot of industries as well. So that's why there's a lot of emphasis on doing hydrogen electrolysis using nuclear power plants, because they also have a similar degree of flexibility, not nearly as good as the Bitcoin miners, but they do offer some of those capabilities. But then where Bitcoin miners really beat them out is on storage, because you have zero storage and transportation for a digital product compared to something that you need to physically store and physically transport to the markets where it would be used. So like, unless your hydrogen is being generated and used pretty much on site, like it's going to have different opportunity costs that need to be considered when engaging with that. Like, so if you've got like a port where you can export a lot of this stuff, like that's great. Like in New Brunswick, we're planning to build some pretty impressive ports system. The Beldune port that runs off coal right now, they want to replace that with entirely nuclear, build a big clean energy industrial park that will also have the manufacturing plant for the reactor that's going to be built on that site. So they'll be able to export that technology, plus a bunch of other like refineries and chemical processors that they'll be able to export. So it really comes down to the priorities of every individual jurisdiction on what industries they want to engage with and what they want their energy profile to look like. And even with potential, like what their future profile wants to look like, because now we have a placeholder technology that we can build the future capacity that we expect to use without any uncertainty that it's going to be underutilized. We will have that placeholder that can make maximum utilization of any electricity that would otherwise go to waste if there wasn't sufficient local demand for it. So yeah, power systems are a very complicated thing that are unique to everywhere where they exist. Like we've got really good, robust systems here in North America, and then you look over in Africa, and as soon as you leave the cities, it's nothing. They're pretty much on their own unless they give themselves like a little microgrid, which is really cool seeing companies like Gridless engage with that. And like, I would like to see, as things progress further in the future, those similar models that they're engaged with being applied to the next generation of small modular reactors that we intend to build. They're going to be in like the one megawatt, 5 megawatt, 50 megawatt, like 100 megawatt blocks, like much smaller capacity that'll be more applicable to smaller markets where gigantic gigawatt size reactor would not be applicable. So it's just weighing the trade-offs of what your markets look like and what your priorities are.
Yeah. And I definitely want to dive into the SMR market, because there have been some positive developments, particularly here in the United States, partnership between Oklo and I believe one of the branches of the military up in Alaska. They're going to be doing a pilot project with their SMR. But before we get to that and how that may look, let's take a step back and just look at nuclear specifically, why it's been demonized in the last 5 decades or 3 decades, probably more specifically. What are the misconceptions around the economics and the safety, and where are we today? Because there seems to be, again, we're at somewhat of a crossroads. You're getting some conflicting narratives across the world where you have Germany decommissioning a bunch of nuclear power plants, and then you have France trying to double down, even though they're running into some problems with their raw material source countries at the moment. But like, why has nuclear had such a hard time getting to where we believe it should be? Like, I believe it's the densest form of energy that we have at our fingertips, and for some reason or another, we're not utilizing it to its full potential, which is a detriment to human flourishing right now.
Yeah, we could definitely be in a much better place had we had not derailed nuclear several times in the last few decades. Like, a lot of the issues with energy systems that we're dealing with right now likely would not be issues that are as contentious and concerning, like where everyone is sourcing their electricity from, and whether it was coming from an adversarial nation or a nation where you were getting uranium from and now they've overthrown their government and refused to sell you uranium at the low prices that you were getting it. Like, it'll derail France for a short time, but they'll probably pivot to getting their uranium from Canada because we have a large abundant uranium resources here. But like, as far as derailing the industry, like, the weapons is definitely one that comes to mind, because for the longest time, the nuclear weapons industry and the nuclear power industry was conflated by people that were kind of ignorant of the finer intricacies of the two technologies. Like, really the only thing that they share in common is the fuel source that they come from. They both use uranium, but then as soon as, they take off on their own individual pathways after that. So like, and even things like the history of mining in the Navajo Nation, that's predominantly for your weapons grade uranium extraction. That had very little to do with the power industry, but because of how it's all tangled together, that's a legacy that needs to be contended with by the whole industry and kind of like move on and atone for some of the historical legacy. And then there's waste has always been an issue because people don't seem to understand the concept of radioactive decay, and that the waste actually becomes safer over time because of the nature of radiation is that the material decays over time. So similar to the Bitcoin issuance supply curve, almost every radiological material has a decay curve where you know the exact period of time where half of that material will be reduced. So in Bitcoin, we know it's every 4 years, and that's our halving cycle. So it's a similar with radiological waste. So the most harmful stuff is the stuff that decays at the fastest rate. So within 50 years, the material that comes out irradiated from a nuclear reactor has had significantly reduced amount of radiation that it will be emitting just because of the nature of how it decays. And then after 150 years, it's no more harmful than the unirradiated material that was put into the reactor in the first place. And that's the fuel itself. And the fuel is a solid product that actually has a very, very small volume. And so the long term, we want to store it in deep geological repositories where it will be safely stored, but also accessible because there is still valuable material and potential power that can left to be generated in those fuel rods. And then there's other types of waste too, like, because tritium is another thing that's been in the news lately because of Fukushima, but it's just water that has two extra neutrons on the hydrogen. It is slightly radioactive, but it doesn't bioaccumulate.
Ryan, we're losing you. There you are.
There, I'm back. All right. I was going on about tritium and just how the concentrations at Fukushima are incredibly low, like relative to the industrial standards. And really the only way that that tritium can attain high enough levels to be harmful more than just like overconsumption of water, that you would have to concentrate it. But by then, if you're concentrating it, then it becomes a valuable commodity that can be sold to companies doing research in fusion. So it's another one of those trade-offs where what we're depending at one point in time, what was waste, now there's new industries that can use it as a feedstock for whatever they're doing. So it's the same thing that the oil industry has been doing for decades, finding clever ways to repurpose what would have been waste into like the various other like polymers and plastics and the bajillion things that we have around us every day that have some element of a petrochemical involved in it. And then there's accidents. Like that's a tough one to contend with because they were very sensationalized. And if you like really deeply examine them, the amount of casualties and fatalities related to them is quite insignificant. It's between the three, I think like you could confidently say maybe 30 fatalities could be directly related to radiation exposure. And there was far more hazard related to the haphazard evacuation of the Fukushima prefecture rather than the actual event that had happened itself. So it's, and it was an easy learning experience to just don't leave your backup generators somewhere where they can potentially get flooded in the case of a giant tsunami. So I had the opportunity to visit one of these reactors in Japan that they're reconfiguring so that they will be able to withstand whatever tsunami happens again in the future. They've built 20 meter tall, 3 meter thick concrete walls around these reactors. They've turned these sites into fortresses, and they also have their backup generators on floating platforms so that there's no way that they can be flooded again. So based on what I've seen, I'm pretty confident that should it ever happen again, the reactor sites on the Japanese island will probably be the safest locations to evacuate to for the population rather than fleeing away from them. And then the other big factor is cost, and cost is another complicated one, because cost goes up because you need to take more safety measures, and often more safety measures are the result of like exaggerating the harm that can actually come from being exposed to radiation. Like right now there's a lot of petitioning to revisit what's known as the linear non-threshold hypothesis, where back in the 20s, there was this researcher that came up with this idea that because there was at higher doses of radiation, you would start to see like cellular failures and cellular mutations and cancers becoming prevalent. But there wasn't any way to detect small levels of radiation. So there was just this, it was a chart with lots of dots like up and to the right, but then there was empty space to the left. And instead of, and so it was just inferred that it was a straight line. So that then that radiation was cumulatively hazardous as you increased your dosage over time. But now they're starting to re-examine that and see that it actually forms more of a J curve, where similar to like exposing yourself to exercise is a good analogy. Like you can jump off a box, a 2 foot box 100 times, and it'll strain your muscle tissue, and then you'll repair and you'll recover and you'll actually be stronger for it. And compare that to jumping off a 200 foot building and having like a large exposure, then it's a completely different ball game with how your body recovers from that, because it can, like a large radiation exposure can expose your body to a large enough radiation dose that it can cause like organ and tissue damage that is difficult to recover. So a lot of this is being re-examined now. And because that was instantiated in a lot of policy related to nuclear power and working with radiological materials, that has ballooned a lot of the costs associated with building nuclear power, because if every doses of radiation is assumed to be harmful, then we need to take an outsized amount of precautions to protect ourselves from it. But like you don't really, like at the very small amounts, like it's no different. You'd be getting roughly the same as like eating a banana or getting a chest x-ray or flying. You have to be repetitively and consistently exposed to radiation for it to have like severe detrimental effects. So then that starts affecting costs. And then Another factor on costs is that there's been a very robust anti-nuclear movement going on since the 70s, and they're financed to the tune of billions of dollars. So they are very active at telling a story that nuclear power is more dangerous than it actually is. And then when policymakers hear that, then they require more safety measures to be taken and then more costs. And then before you know it, it costs a lot of money to build a nuclear reactor. And then one of the modern problems that we're having now is because nuclear reactors in the West haven't been built in 30 plus years, you don't have a fully engaged workforce and supply chain that is ready and aligned to build nuclear reactors. So like building the Vogtle reactor and the Hinkley Point C reactor are like they essentially had to restart their labor force and their supply chains from scratch. So that has caused a lot of ballooning of costs of these projects. And then on top of all of that is the cost of capital being relegated to controversial high risk investment categories. Like you're going to be paying high interest rates on loans for a project like this. And when you're taking out billions of dollars in loans to build a project that you don't expect to be paid back for 40 years, like the cost of capital can accrue quite quickly. And as you can see on, there's a chart for the Hinkley reactor that shows 2/3 of the cost of that reactor is just paying off the interest alone. So like if we can get it into just the more like the green taxonomy investment categories, then that will open up a lot more opportunity for investors to invest in nuclear power without having to deal with like the same like high costs of doing so and the higher risks of doing so. There'll be a lot more stakeholders and shareholders kind of sharing that risk. So like right now, something that's happening is because Europe had put nuclear power in their green taxonomy so that it can get better access to investment and different investment groups and categories, their Greenpeace, who we all know and love, is petitioning the European Parliament to remove nuclear from that green taxonomy. And then there's like this sub group of environmentalists, because the environmentalists now are like the ones that believe that the apocalypse is nigh, but that we don't need nuclear power. And then there's the ones that believe that we have to prepare for the apocalypse, but we need nuclear power. So they're starting to infight a lot against each other. So there's this group called Replanet that's now petitioning the EU, counter-petitioning them against Greenpeace. So there's this whole like group of environmentalists really starting to get after each other about the fact that like whether or not we should have nuclear power as playing a larger role in dealing with the climate change concerns that many of our society has these days.
Yeah, the whole Greenpeace thing just doesn't make any sense. If you believe the end is nigh, which I'm sure many people listening to the show and you yourself, Ryan, may be aware, I don't believe the end is nigh, but if we run with the assumption that it is, it seems that and the end is nigh is being driven by carbon emissions, CO2 emissions particularly, and methane emissions, then you would rapidly want to transition to nuclear, considering that the emissions profile is much, much lower than comparative fuel sources. It doesn't make any sense.
You'd think so, but they've been hating on uranium far longer than they've been hating on carbon. So it's basically the same people. They just transitioned to a newer, more hip movement that they can frame a narrative around.
It's also tiresome. But going back to the cost of capital problem, do you think the small modular reactor movement is a sly roundabout way to get over that, start on a smaller scale, have shorter payback periods, and sort of prove out that, hey, nuclear's safe, it's reliable, and it can be cheap? And then from there, once people see that data, they'll be more confident to bucket nuclear power into a green bucket so that you can get cheaper cost of capital and then go build larger reactors.
Yeah, that's part of the game plan. It's like serial construction of these things is the name of the game. Like that's how we drive down the marginal cost of production per unit, is just by building as many as we can. Like now that all the capital expenses have been put together, or getting that supply chain and that labor force aligned to build Vogtle, like now is when you parlay that into build more and build a lot more. Because that's the Westinghouse AP1000. So that's one of the first ones that's been built. since it's been available, of the Gen 3 technologies. Like, a lot of these reactors were already being proposed back around like 2010 time, but all of that got derailed when Fukushima happened. So it is a very huge milestone for just the entire global industry that Vogtle is operational now, because had that have failed, like, it could have collapsed the entire industry. So that's reassuring. And then, like, one of the other things, like, yeah, with the SMRs, the serial production in a mass manufacturing type of style, like, that is the idea that we want to kind of put forward for the next generation of reactors. They want to build them like airplanes and shipping freighters. Just, it'll just be on an assembly line, and then they'll just pump out every few months. There'll be a new one that pumps up, and then they'll be able to ship it, depending on the size, ship it to site and stand it up and commission it within 6 months to a year. And the bigger ones, and to get up to the 300 megawatt range, roughly the 2 year range that they're looking at for shipping it to site and then having it fully commissioned. So the bigger they get, the more components that they will be shipping. Like, the really, really small ones, like 1 megawatt and the 5 megawatt, they'll be able to ship those just on a truck bed and stand them up within a few weeks to a few months. And then, yeah, as you get larger, you get more complexity. And then they'll have different cooling types. So some will use like high temperature gas, some will use molten salts, some will use like a liquid metal. And I think there's one that's like uses like a graphite moderator. So at the moment there's like 70 of these companies that are proposing different designs that are trying to get them to market. So the big race right now is getting that first of a kind built, proven, demonstrated, show off all of the different safety features that are being proposed and how it can collaborate with different industries to work well with hybrid energy systems and microgrids and larger grids that are serviced by a smaller generator that doesn't need to be in the gigawatt range.
And with the SMR movement beginning to gain steam, like, what do you think the impact could be on grid systems, whether they be small, sort of geographically remote areas, and then bigger metropolitan areas like Austin, Texas, where I am today? Like, how could this impact grid systems positively or negatively?
Well, I think it'll give local areas a lot more autonomy on their grid systems. So, like, you'll be able to have like a microgrid around specific jurisdictions that then can be, then you can have interconnections with your surrounding grids, much to how the system is now, but just more, just distributed and at a smaller size. So instead of the large big grids that we have, it'll be a connection of lots of smaller grids. And then for stuff that doesn't even have access to the grid, like, that's one of the things that we want to do with this 5 megawatt reactor that's going to be built by UltraSafe Nuclear Company. They're collaborating with our public utility, Ontario Power Generation, and they want to build the first of a kind demonstration unit where I work here at Canadian Nuclear Laboratories and test that out. But the long-term game plan for that is they want to use it to upgrade remote northern communities and like actual physical mining operations off of diesel generation and up to nuclear power. So then that will displace a lot of their diesel from power and heat generation, and then they can prioritize it for like transportation and heavy machinery usage and get a lot more value out of it than just for power and electricity. And then it will also benefit a lot of these remote northern communities, because it's more, you can, because they come in like the 5 megawatt modules, you can right size them as the community. So if, say, some, for example, Iqaluit and Nunavut is in the far north, and they at their peak they use about 25 megawatts, but then in their summer low they use about 15 megawatts. So you're going to have like a lot of these variance gaps in there. But what they'd ideally do is build a 30 watt capacity using 6 units, and then you can have that enough for your maximum, your peak load available, and then you can curtail something else to match your generation profile. So that's where I kind of see mining playing a big role, where we want to deploy these reactors where there isn't sufficient demand. Because I've gone through like these lists of different power projects that were proposed in all of these like off-grid areas in northern Canada, in Alaska, and they're like, well, we want to build this hydroelectric dam. It's going to be 200 megawatts, but we only need 30 megawatts. So there's no value in building it. So they'll put years of preliminary work and financing and costs into it and just scrap it because of uncertain demand. And like uncertain demand has killed hundreds and hundreds of power projects. And now we can bring our own demand by just plugging in computers. So that solves a big problem because it allows us to get very creative with how we want to distribute this nuclear power instead of having it try to balance with other generation sources. Like if you want to fill, like, so that you don't use that, leave capacity stranded, instead of building 30 megawatts of reactors, part of the proposals now are like, well, we can build a few windmills and then build some batteries and then have this thermal storage component. And in some places, like, those ideas will work out all right. But I think it will be greatly simplified if we just build excess with nuclear, fill in a placeholder, and then we can curtail a load as needed to match whatever the community needs. And then as the communities grow and evolve, they can either add more generation capacity or they can peel away ASICs and sell them on the robust like marketplaces that we're starting to see for secondhand ASICs. So there's any number of strategies that can be employed for deploying these reactors now, and we can get a lot more creative because of their smaller size and applicability to a lot more different markets.
Well, let's dive further into this because and really highlight why Bitcoin mining is uniquely positioned to solve this problem. Because the way I understand it, nuclear power plants, they're going to produce a certain amount of electricity and they can't really deramp or ramp up above or below that level. And when you compare that to something like a natural gas peaker plant, they can do that pretty flexibly due to the fuel source and the flexibility that comes with natural gas, but nuclear does not have that flexibility, correct?
It has a degree of flexibility. Certain types, like, they can ramp down to about like 70% of their capacity at a ramp rate of about like a few megawatts per 15 minutes. So they can't just go on and off like we can just flip on and off like the miners, but there is that capability. And with the newer ones, they're trying to enhance that capability as much as possible. But even with the ability to do that, like, you're still putting by cycling your thermal output up and down all the time, you're going to be putting unnecessary strain on your turbines and your core and other vital components of your generation source. So like, it works the same with the natural gas plants. A natural gas plant runs more efficient and puts out less emissions per kilowatt generated if it's running at a consistent output. If you're up and down all the time, like, you're going to be putting unnecessary stress on your equipment, and you're going to be emitting more per kilowatt. So if we want to be eliminating emissions, then we should be finding a way to run our generators at a more consistent rate.
Yeah. And Bitcoin mining is uniquely suited to do this, right? Because
it's perfect.
Co-locate, just ramp up and ramp down the miners instead of the reactor, depending on the demand at any given point in time.
Yeah, and you can right size them to be perfectly matched. And like, you can even, like, there are trade-offs, but you could in theory use multiple tiers of different ASICs that have different break-even points so that you can react to two different levels of responsiveness on the grid. Like, you would need more maintenance requirements if you're having to take care of both like S9s and S19s and M30s rather than just having one system that's all just M30s. It'd be easier maintenance wise, but that would be the trade-off you'd have to make depending on what your load profile looks like. Because if you do have a load, or if your demand profile has it so that your mining load would be curtailing and your mining load capacity factor was like less than 90%, then maybe you don't want it to be 100% of the newest generation miners because the capex that goes into that and whatnot. But it might make sense to have 90% of that load with your latest generation miners and then 10% of that load with some older miners that are just there and available to buffer that margin at the edge of your supply and demand curve. So it'll be interesting to see how these different strategies play out, because it's going to be a very changing environment when we start seeing more of these power generators figure out how to do this and ways that they can employ it. And I think it's only a matter of time before one of these big mining companies gets bought out by a giant power company, or vice versa.
Well, The narrative I heard, and I'd really like to hear whether or not this is true, but another way in which Bitcoin mining can help, particularly on the capital side of things, is when you plop down these reactors, you may be able to set them up within a certain period of time, but then in certain areas, you need to build out transmission. And you can try to do that in parallel, but the timing's not always perfect, and that sort of messes up the capital structure because you can set up the reactor, but then you can't actually sell electricity because there's no transmission. But with mining, you can set up the reactor, mine with that electricity as the transmission's being built out, and then once the transition's built out, you can peel off some miners and rinse and repeat down the road.
Yeah, you essentially have a digital conduit that can serve as in place of your physical conduit until you have it available to deliver it to wherever you need it locally. And then you also have your physical limitations of how far you can actually transmit electricity before it's not feasible anymore. Like Quebec is a fascinating example because they deliver hydroelectric generation like all the way from James Bay to into like the northern states that they border in like New Hampshire and Maine. And what's happened is for the longest time, Quebec has generated a lot of electricity, like an overabundance of electricity. So they've had very robust export markets. But then as more of their neighbors have started to lean on those export markets, we've started to see things like New York get away with shutting down in Indian Point. And then a few other generation assets have been shut down in like in that vicinity of the northern U.S. So now they're starting to put a strain on the Quebec's capacity, and they don't have enough to serve all of their neighbors and themselves at the same time, especially in the winter when they start heating their peak demand, because Quebec is predominantly electrical heating, which could be replaced by ASICs if we can get creative on that front. But so now Quebec is actually considering restarting a nuclear power plant that they had shut down 12, 13 years or so ago. And there was no expectation whatsoever that that nuclear power plant was ever going to be revived. And now it's become something, a serious talking point here in Canada amongst all the other advancements we have going on for nuclear. Like we have our big fleet in Ontario that's 20 reactors. They're all CANDU reactors here in Canada. And so that just uses heavy water instead of light water. And yeah, there's talk they want to expand 5 gigawatts at the Bruce reactor site. They want to, we're not sure what reactor that's going to be. It's going to be bid out probably between CANDU reactor, Westinghouse, and possibly the South Koreans with that APR 1400 that they just finished in the UAE. They'll go through that whole bidding process. I would like it to be the CANDU reactors because that's homegrown Canadian technology, but I will settle for more nuclear just in general. And then at our Darlington site, we have a shovel-ready site that was built and prepared, and transmission was already put there for what was expected to be an advanced CANDU reactor that was supposed to be built in the early 2000s, late 90s, but then changing in politics and changing in demand profiles for the province, that ended up falling through and never happened. So they've got a shovel-ready site that they're going to use for demonstrating a 4-pack of GE Hitachi's 300-megawatt boiled water reactor. So that's where that's going to get its first-of-a-kind demonstration site. And then out in New Brunswick is where we have a single CANDU reactor, but they're going to use that site because it's already licensed to build a demonstration for the Moltex stable salt waste burner reactor, which will predominantly be fueled by reprocessed fuel from the traditional fleet, so that it can be similar to how the fast reactors that Russia and France and Japan all have, that are able to consume their spent fuel and get more power out of them and actually generate more usable isotopes inside of the fuel in the reactor that can self-propel the reaction and actually generate more electricity as the different isotopes are converted into more fissile isotopes. So it's actually a pretty cool technology, the way that they can use the molten salts and the mixed oxide fuels to extract more energy out of the fuel than was initially even there to begin with. And then and I'd mentioned the Beldune port is another one that they want to build in New Brunswick. It's going to use the ARC 100 megawatt reactor, and it's also going to be a molten salt. So there's big advances going on in Canada, and then like I think all throughout Europe, basically everybody but Germany and I think maybe Austria, are they're like all about nuclear. Like Poland wants to get big on nuclear. They wanted 12 of those 300 megawatt BWRX units that Hitachi's building at Darlington. They're talking with the Koreans right now about getting one or two of the similar units that they just built in Abu Dhabi. They're talking with Westinghouse about AP1000s. Like Poland's not screwing around. They want to get their energy game and not be dependent upon any neighbors ever again. Like Estonia, Lithuania, like all these Eastern Bloc countries, they're very much looking forward to ramping up their nuclear power capacity in a way that will make them independent from being reliant upon any of their neighbors. Because as we saw, things can get tricky being dependent upon your neighbors and your friendly nations. But yeah, if you become dependent upon adversarial nations, you can get cut off pretty quickly when things go sideways. So a lot of these nations don't want to be caught with their pants down in a situation like that ever again. So they're looking towards the future, and their future involves a lot of nuclear power. Like even the Nordic countries that have really good wind resources, they're starting to lean more towards increasing their nuclear capacity. Like a recent government elected in Sweden has reversed Sweden's position on nuclear, and they want to build more capacity. Norway definitely likes nuclear. Finland likes nuclear. Denmark, I think Denmark's like the only one up there that doesn't really have much nuclear. But all over Europe, like I'm hearing tons of stuff throughout, like many nations in Africa are looking into getting into nuclear power. So like SMRs would be a lot more appropriate for many of their markets because they don't have sufficient grid infrastructure to support like a large gigawatt sized reactor. But we will see as things go in time. And yeah, it's very exciting for the nuclear industry right now because yeah, India is building a shitload of nuclear reactors. China is building a shitload of nuclear reactors. Japan wants to restart their entire fleet and start building more. South Korea wants to build a ton of reactors. They've already proven that they can export their technology to other nations. UAE, they just built 4. They already want 2 more. All of their neighbors are paying attention to what's going on there. Saudi Arabia is talking with China because for the longest time they've been denied the ability to get nuclear power by their relationship with the United States and being overly controlling over the fuel supply lines. So that seems to be an interesting situation because the West could have offered Saudi Arabia nuclear technology, but now they're going to China to get it just because of the way that we were paranoid about proliferation and whatnot. But what are you going to do?
Yeah. Well, based off of that monologue, I have 3 things I want to touch on. How idiotic are the moves that Germany has made over the last couple of decades? Number one. Number two, do we have enough uranium on the planet to build out the nuclear future that you envision? And then number three, if there's plenty uranium to go around and we can actually build all this out, like what does that mean for the violence in the world? Like how does each individual nation being able to produce reliable baseload pretty consistently change the nature of the geopolitical landscape?
Yeah, that's going to evolve in ways that we're not going to foresee how that plays out. But like we can predict all we want, but I predict more energy for more people is going to be better. But yeah, we'll start with Germany because that is definitely presenting an example to the world of what not to do with your power systems if you want a reliable system, as we're now seeing that they are tearing down windmill farms so that they can obtain the coal that is underneath them, which is a strange reversal. The other crazy thing about Germany is, yeah, because they've now done that, it's like they can still, Germany's still a wealthy nation, so they can afford to buy coal and they can afford to buy gas off just the global markets. But then that has the secondary effect of driving up the cost of those commodities on that market for developing nations that were kind of dependent upon them staying at a reasonable cost. And now Germany can just throw their weight around and buy it for whatever they want. And then it forces up, yeah, makes it more difficult for other nations that aren't as lucky to get there. And then seeing the amount of like historical, like high quality industry that Germany has had for centuries that withstood both world wars that are now considering leaving Germany for other jurisdictions. Like what the hell happened that it's gotten that bad that like you'd think that they would reverse course when things like that would start to happen. But I don't pretend to understand the mind of politicians and bureaucrats. Just when you think you can got a handle on them, they never cease to surprise you. But Germany's going to do what Germany does, and they may provide a great example, counterexample to the world as to how to not handle your power systems. Or for all we know, they come out the other side of this with a huge array of windmills and solar panels and batteries, and they make it work. I don't think the odds are in their favor, but crazier shit's happened. But then uranium, we've got tons of uranium. Like Canada alone, like if we had the will to do so, like we only have two major deposits that are active in northern Saskatchewan. But from what I understand, there is an obscene amount available, like all throughout northern Canada, that just it's not as high quality or grades. So that's why they're not as ambitious to go after it. But if the demand for uranium increases, that is something that is available that Canada can tap into. There's many other nations, like there's lots of the African nations. They do have uranium deposits, but they have complicated political situations at the moment that makes those markets kind of tricky to manage. But then, yeah, like the Russia, Kazakhstan, Australia actually has a really robust uranium mining industry, even though they reject nuclear power quite vehemently, which is strange because they could benefit from it greatly, especially many of the nations in their vicinity that are like island nations could really work well with like small reactors. And then the other place that we can get uranium from, there is actually in seawater, there's, I forget the exact, it's like 6 parts per billion or something. It's a very low concentration, but there are technologies that can extract that out of the seawater. And then it does replenish itself because of just the equilibrium between the concentration in the seawater and the land and the soil and then rock formations that are around it. It will erode that as if that equilibrium is disturbed. So if we were determined, we could extract an obscene amount of uranium out of ocean water. So it's just a matter of the market economics of doing so more than anything. And if there's lots of easily available uranium, like in deposits in Canada and Russia and Australia, obviously those are the ones that are going to be prioritized first. But, and then on top of that, because like we can generate different isotopes in once exposed to nuclear radiation that create new isotopes that weren't fissile before that are now fissile. And then on top of that, there's thorium. So thorium has a slightly different supply chain than uranium because it's not naturally fissile. It's fertile. So like I was mentioning, like it has to be exposed to a neutron environment for it to become an isotope that is naturally fissile. And then it can be used as fuel in a nuclear reactor. So, and they just kind of self feeds on the fuel that's inside of itself. It'll create new fuel and then feed on that fuel and then create new fuel. And so that's kind of the ambitious plan for these new molten salt reactors, that they'll basically be able to reprocess, use recycled fuel and then like reprocess it and get a lot more energy out of them. What does it all mean is we're going to have a lot more power available to humanity than we know what to do with. Like that's pretty much been the game plan. But then there's been many of I forget what the heck that guy's name is. He was one of the very pro-environmentalist guys back in the 70s. He was the one that made that bet about commodities diminishing over time. And essentially, he made the claim that giving humanity infinite power would be like handing like a shotgun to a small child, and that we would just wreck up the place with having technology abundantly available to us like that. But I think that is more of a side effect of fiat culture more than anything, because like we can be better, but just the technology we use and how we use it is a reflection of the health of our society. And having gone down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and the fiat rabbit holes, and it's just that this level of corruption on our society, it's not the technology that we have available to us. It's how we use it and how we prioritize it and how we think about the future. But like, if we can get power to places where it's never been before, like we can change the lives of everybody on the planet. And because nuclear is the one that's going to save our ass. Because like I've been watching like events in South Africa and Lebanon, these places where they'll just power will just turn off. They'll give you a heads up that you're not going to have power for a few hours. So then you start having to prioritize when and how you use your power. And like we're starting to see that creep more and more into the Western markets. And like that's a sign of a failing system. And it's a much harder to go backwards than it is to go forwards. Like once we've adapted to having a lot of power, if we reverse course, we are going to have a tough time, especially with the state of divisiveness in the Western nations like Canada and the United States right now. If we start having to really, really fight over scarce resources, these people are going to start tearing each other apart and it's not going to be pretty. So I think one of the best ways to avoid that is to just make sure that everybody has the resources we need available, and nuclear power is going to be able to do that. Like we'll be able to feed people and make sure they have good, adequate water resources and health infrastructure and educational infrastructure. Just it all is second order from just getting power. If you don't have power, you can't have any of that stuff. Or like, even if you do, it sucks.
Yeah. And you really sent my mind down an interesting rabbit hole. Like when you factor in the ability for nuclear power to replace certain forms of hydrocarbon generation, and then you can use those hydrocarbons for other petroleum products, which can drive down prices lower for things like fertilizer, the plastic that's used in this mic, in this camera. Like the positive externalities that can emanate from simply not having to use those as a fuel source and being able to use them for end products that aren't energy could be massive from an economics perspective.
Yeah, we'll be able to make, like, we'll have the power available to make, like, synthetic hydrocarbons and, like, whatever we want. Like, if we want to be making, like, jet fuel, like, we'll be able to just take lower order, like, hydrogen and base chemicals, and then it just requires a lot of heat and steam and power to combine them to make those higher order chemicals that can actually be used as fuel and fertilizer and feedstock for countless other operations and industries that we have these days. So it's just a matter of climbing up that stack. The more power we have available, the more creative we can get with how we use what we have available to us.
Yeah. With that in mind, I know we've got a shot clock here of about 10 minutes. And just to wrap up in the last part of this conversation is really to tie the Bitcoin mining industry and the nuclear industry together. What are you seeing on the front lines? Are people in your industry beginning to recognize the value prop that Bitcoin mining can provide as they look to build out these small modular reactors and larger reactors down the line? Like, are people understanding the economic benefit that the mining industry can provide nuclear?
They're starting to, like, there's a few bits and pieces where you can see that they are paying attention. But like I watched a seminar the other day, and it was going through all of the different technologies that we want to collaborate with for nuclear power, and noticeably data centers was not on that list. And I'm like just even data centers in general should be on these lists for how to deploy like big power infrastructure with having a certain demand like load available with it. So even if it is the always on type of data centers and web services and like sensitive information, like that sort of stuff, like that's going to be a huge draw on power as well. But where I did find interesting was a few months ago, I was in Minneapolis, and while I was there, I actually got an opportunity to hit up Brandon Quittam's meetup. We did a talk with Nazar Khan was there as well, and we were talking about Talon Energy and what they're up to at Susquehanna. But what I did not expect was at the nuclear conference itself that I was there for, the North American Young Generation in Nuclear, the only reason I'm going to these conferences is because I won a contest. They had a contest that was, how can we apply nuclear power to the UN Sustainable Development Goals? And I was like, by applying Bitcoin mining to it. Nuclear power already applies to all those goals, and we can amplify it with Bitcoin mining. It was really that simple. And then I won it, and then I went to a few conferences, but then at this one specific conference in Minneapolis, they had the chief nuclear officer of the Susquehanna power plant, where the Talon Energy, TerraWolf, Cumulus Coin data center has been built. He actually gave a presentation to the conference about the data center and how it was built out in the process and the people involved and their plans for expansion and like how they're using it for demand response and different other strategies that they have for their growth and coming into the halving and their power price, which is obscenely low compared to everyone else. So they're going to be just fine. And so anybody that was not paying attention before then definitely is, because there was representatives from across the entire industry there. There was like the president of XL Energy, the president of Southern Power, was like Celestial Energy, Entergy, like Constellation. Yeah, there was the who's who of the nuclear industry from across Canada was there in that room listening to that presentation. So that was very cool. And then just on the other things, just like when I get the opportunity to present it to like random people throughout my company, like sometimes there's hesitancy and resistance because the things that they've heard about Bitcoin. Definitely having the BlackRock ETF in play makes it a little easier because of the institutional credibility. So it's a lot easier of a pill to swallow for like nuclear executives rather than having not that institutional cover to make it easier to discuss in these circles. But once you explain just like the basic idea of it's just a load that we can match to any generation profile, and we can pair it up it perfectly with any nuclear power asset that we want to build, they do start to see the value in it, especially because that the flexibility is like nothing else. And especially like the way I kind of lead them to it is we'll go through the different technologies that are used as demand response, and like we'll talk about the different industrial loads or like a residential like time of use kind of programs that they do, and ultimately just lead them to be like, all right, so now we've got just a flexible load that we can operate like a dimmer switch. Like that is at the tip pinnacle of demand response and being able to respond to any changes we see in these loads, like right at the fine level of frequency even. Because it's like right now they have regulators that will just dump that load and it doesn't do anything of value with it. But if you were to just dump load into an ASIC, like then you could generate a little bit of hash rate, and like, so what if you're only making like a few cents here and there? It's actually a benefit to the grid to just have it there and available, even if you couldn't earn anything profitable off of it, because they already use something that's just gets them $0 when they curtail that electricity anyways. So they are catching on. It's just it's a slow grind. And like I'm fully aware that like the seeds that I'm planting right now like may not start bearing fruit for like 5-10 years, but this is a long game we've got to play here.
Well, Ryan, I want to thank you for planting the seeds. I think the work that you're doing is extremely important. I think as Bitcoiners, we can sort of get inoculated in our own narrative bubble. And it's very important to have individuals like yourself out there on the front lines, really trying to get this message out to people in positions of power that can actually drive change, particularly at the within the energy sector. And with that in mind, I know we have to wrap up here. Is there anything we didn't cover that you want to mention before we end the show?
I don't know. I'm sure there was definitely something I missed. Like I didn't really go through much of the different companies that are being worked on with this, but like I can list them off right now. Like just like Westinghouse, Hitachi, Terrestrial Energy, Arc Energy, Moltex, Rolls-Royce, Kairos, TerraPower, Holtec, NuScale, X Energy, Oklo. Like all these companies are in like the early stages of like financing themselves. So if there are people that want to invest in nuclear power, like reach out to these companies and see what you can do with them. Like they're more than happy to speak with people that have money and want to see them succeed. So that's yeah, I want to see it succeed. So if I'm just happen to be the guy that can start putting these puzzle pieces together and connecting the right people, like I take every little connection I make as a victory.
We're going to win. Are we going to win?
Fucking right. I certainly hope so. From this perspective, the future looks a lot brighter than it would have otherwise. Like, yeah, I was very pessimistic before Bitcoin, but I see a light opening up, and it creeps up even wider when we start attaching nuclear to it. We're going to supercharge everything.
But, follow the light freaks.
We got to fix Canada though first. Like, I don't know what the hell's going on. So yeah, you see this right here? WD-40. Trudeau wants to make this illegal in Canada.
Why?
Yeah. I don't know. We don't know. That was just announced last week, that something to do with aerosols. And like, he's already taken away our plastic bags and our plastic utensils. Like when I landed, one of the first things I was really excited about when I landed in Minneapolis was I got to use a plastic straw. It was very exciting.
Yeah.
But
It's the small things. It's the little things that people take for granted until the Cuban nipple crisis hits you and you're forced to.
Oh, yeah. Our politics is going to heat up, too. Like, yeah, you guys got your Circus 24 just starting to heat up. Like, ours can get called randomly at any time. If it doesn't get called randomly, it's going to be after yours. But, yeah, with Pierre and Trudeau in play, like, things are going to get very interesting. Because, like, as much as I like Trudeau and he's saying the things that I like to hear, that makes me want to scrutinize him even more. Because, yeah, I don't know. It sounds like... I don't know if you watch much professional wrestling, but that's kind of how I view politics. Is just
kayfabe.
Yeah, the heels and the baby face, and they just they're all just characters playing a role, and they'll switch roles as needed to tell the story.
Yeah, we need to get the politicians out of the way, and hopefully the free market, Bitcoin, nuclear proliferation will help that. Ryan, thank you for taking some time out of your workday to sit down with us and educate us about the state of the nuclear energy and the potential it has moving forward. Again, I think the work that you're doing is extremely important. Just want to thank you for doing it. And thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. If anybody wants to find me, Nuclear Bitcoiner on Twitter, Noster, Orange Pill app, those are my primaries that I message people through. And yeah, it was great talking to you. I love your work. Love all this work and about the intersection of power and Bitcoin mining. It's a fascinating new space that's growing very quickly.
I think it's probably the most important intersection of Bitcoin in any other industry at this particular point in time. So the work you're doing is really exciting, and keep crushing it.
Thank you, sir.
All right. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love. Tiki!